From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. New state laws could raise prospects for employment and housing by letting thousands of Marylanders clear parts of their criminal records or shield some minor convictions from public view. We hear from a policy advocate and a mother made unemployable by a felony arrest. Then Tom Hall talks to Daniel James Brown about his book, The Boys in the Boat, 9 young American rowers who beat the odds to triumph at the 1936 Olympics. It's this year's One Maryland, One Book community reading project. And saxophonist and jazz composer Carl Grubbs tells Tom about his new piece, inspired by the Inner Harbor, that will be part of Free Fall Baltimore, the month-long celebration of the arts that kicks off tomorrow. And a new festival in which the streets of Little Italy become a kind of canvas. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. With a big thank you to everyone who supported WYPR in this pledge drive. You keep us going. Thank you. Now, this morning's focus. About a third of all Americans have a criminal record, less than 5% for violent crimes. Some of the consequences of a criminal record are obvious, like fines, probation, jail time, and parole. Not as obvious are collateral consequences that affect employment, public assistance, housing, and voting rights. Several new laws take effect tomorrow that could allow Marylanders with criminal records to expunge or shield some parts of them from public view. One new law would also allow violations that are no longer crimes, like possession of small amounts of marijuana, to be removed from people's records. To tell us more about the new laws, we're joined by Karen Oslan, senior policy advocate at the nonprofit Job Opportunities Task Force. She's lobbied the legislature for these new laws. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Sheila.
And also with us is Danielle. She's 37, has 7 children, and a criminal record for an arrest that resulted in no trial and no conviction. The offense occurred during a domestic violence dispute in 2002. Danielle, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Sheila.
Well, let's start. Tell us how you ended up having a record in the first place.
I was in an abusive relationship, and during an attack, I fought back. And once the police arrived, they informed me that I would be arrested as well due to a new law at the time, which was around June 2002. And I was arrested and
charged with what?
Charged with 2 separate counts of deadly weapon with the intent to injure and 1 second-degree assault charge.
So were those felony charges?
Yes.
And what happened?
Well, I went to court a month later, and it was placed on stat.
Placed on stat means?
That means the indefinite postponement of the case.
Indefinitely postponed, okay.
And after that, I was told that if I were to break the law, get in trouble again, get charged, well, arrested and charged, that the state could pick up those previous charges and pursue a case, a trial against me, and I would be convicted.
But your understanding was that if you didn't have any further brushes with the law, those charges from 2002...
They were going to remain on my record. However, I had to stay out of trouble. That was what was explained to me.
And is that what happened?
Well, yes, I didn't get any trouble. However, the charges remained on my record, and each attempt that I made to have my record expunged was null and void. You know, they said I was not able to expunge my record because I had violent felonies. And
the charges were violent felonies.
Yes.
You had not been convicted of violent
Never
felonies.
Convicted.
Let me ask Karen to walk us through the laws that take effect tomorrow and what that means for someone like Danielle.
Tomorrow, there are a number of laws that would allow individuals to restrict public access to their dated records. The Maryland Second Chance Act pertains to certain nonviolent misdemeanor convictions. These are offenses such as disorderly conduct, drug possession, prostitution. You were found guilty, and you can petition the courts to shield that information from public view.
Those are nonviolent misdemeanors.
Nonviolent misdemeanor convictions. You were found guilty. You were found guilty. Now, in Danielle's case, she's talking about what's considered a non-conviction. And this is really important to note because you think that individuals face barriers to employment and housing due to a guilty conviction. But what most folks don't, what they don't know is that it's actually a number of individuals that are struggling with non-convictions. And so in Danielle's case, she has a STET. She has three STETed cases that prevented her from getting her record expunged. She was not found guilty. As she mentioned, it was a result of a domestic violence incident. And so on Thursday, October 1st, one of the laws would allow individuals who have records for non-convictions, these are STETs, dismissals, if your case was null prost, meaning that the state's attorney declined to prosecute, those offenses would become eligible for shielding, become eligible for expungement, regardless of any subsequent convictions for separate unrelated charges.
While the first category you talked about were misdemeanors, this could include felony charges.
Absolutely. This includes felony offenses, and it includes whether they are violent or nonviolent. What's important to note is that regardless of whether they're felonies or misdemeanors, violent or nonviolent, these individuals were not found guilty.
So you just made a slip of the tongue, which I think all of us who are not lawyers are having trouble keeping straight. What's the difference between shielding and expungement?
Shielding is different from expungement in that shielding retains access to the record for certain entities. So law enforcement would have access to shielded records, the courts, certain employers that by law have to access criminal background information, so daycares, hospitals, licensing boards, those entities would retain access to shielded records. So for instance, if I were to apply and were successful in having my record shielded, no one would have access to my record except those entities that I mentioned. Expungement is different from shielding in that no one has access to your record. Law enforcement, courts, no one has access to the record. The access is only allowed as a result of a court order.
That's Karen Aslan, Senior Policy Advocate at the Nonprofit Job Opportunities Task Force here on Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Danielle, a 37-year-old mother who has a felony arrest on her record, no conviction, from 2002. We're using just Danielle's first name for obvious reasons. And I'm trying to understand, so with this felony arrest, Danielle, are you looking at the possibility now with this new law of expungement or shielding?
Expungement. Yes.
You're hoping to get this wiped off your
Absolutely.
Record, which you have not been able to do before. You've tried.
Not ever before.
What has been the impact on your life of having this? I mean, it's not a conviction. Many of us would think, okay, she wasn't convicted. It must not be having any impact.
A very negative impact, I would say. I have not been able to secure gainful employment with the record and my gap in employment history. The time that I last worked was so many years ago. And when they pull the record, that's a double whammy. You know, they're not going to hire me.
How have you been keeping body and soul together if you can't get a job?
I, you know, utilize public assistance and various other means. I have a lot of skills and trades and gifts that I use to, you know, help support myself and my family.
And what will happen if you are able to get this arrest record expunged?
I will try to get every job in the world.
What kind of job do you intend to try to get?
I would like to work with youth and or ex-offenders in building leadership. Also, I would like to work with art. I'm also an artist. I love art. It's my passion. And my mind is like everywhere. I would like to cook, or I would like to babysit, or you know, go back to doing geriatric care. It opens the world up. I don't feel like I have this stigma and, you know, I have the free record to go along with it. I feel like a new person. It's like a rebirth.
And Karen, I just want to make sure I'm understanding. With expungement, then, if Danielle were to apply for a job, say, in a child care center, that arrest, like it never happened?
It's like it never happened. And she does not have to disclose that she has expunged information.
The Maryland Chamber of Commerce opposed some of these bills. The argument was that employers need all the information they can get when they're hiring, and that this activity, even if there wasn't a conviction, goes to the character of the job applicant. Danielle, what would you say?
I don't agree with that. I think it may be a case-by-case issue where some people are not rehabilitated. They still struggle with issues from the act or, you know, what followed behind it. In my scenario, I was basically defending myself, you know, which still baffles me to this day. It really, like, it took everything from me.
Every year in Annapolis, when we would travel to Annapolis to advocate to get these bills passed, you had grown men and women that would break down at the hearings to say they just want to be able to support their families like everyone else. And they're not able to do that if a criminal record from years ago, especially if it's a criminal record where you weren't even found guilty, if this non-conviction, if this instance is preventing me from being able to be the citizen, the productive citizen, the good parent, the good community leader that you are expecting of me, then you have to make sure that I have access to those same opportunities like everyone else does.
And so what do you say to employers who say, it's tough to make hiring decisions. We need all the information we can get.
To be clear, I don't think that this is an instance of us telling or government telling businesses how to run their business. We would never want to present employers or require that employers have to undergo an arduous process in terms of determining who would be ideal employees. But what we are trying to articulate to employers and to the public in general is this idea that if I've served my time and if I've paid my debt after a certain period of time, you should be able to judge me based on merit, based on what rehabilitative steps that I've taken since I've committed that offense, and what skills I can bring to the position at which I'm applying. As Danielle mentioned, it's really important for employers to look at individuals on a case-by-case basis and determine if whether or not their prior offenses are relevant to the job at hand, whether or not it's serious enough to endanger the individuals on their workplace, and whether or not it's going to prevent the employees on the workplace or the prospective employee from really being able to ensure that the business is productive. So we want to make sure that employers have the information that they need, but having access to a full background check does not mean that will determine whether or not that individual is an ideal employee. You have to take other factors into account.
I really appreciate your walking us through it. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Danielle, a mother and artist who plans to pursue expungement of the felony arrest on her record. Karen Oslan is senior policy advocate at the nonprofit Job Opportunities Task Force. JOTF and several other partners are holding a clinic tomorrow to answer questions about shielding and expungement. It's at New Psalmist Baptist Church in Northwest Baltimore, accessible by subway and bus. More information at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, author Daniel James Brown. Stay tuned to 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Everybody on 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Let me add my thanks to everybody who pitched in to make our fall membership campaign such a big success. We really, really appreciate your listening, your support, and your interest. My guest this morning is Daniel James Brown. He's the author of New York Times' number one best-selling book, The Boys in the Boat. It tells the amazing story of a group of 9 young American rowers who, against all odds, triumph at the 1936 Olympics, stealing thunder from Adolf Hitler's Nazi regime and transforming the sport. The Boys in the Boat has been chosen as this year's One Maryland, One Book selection by the Maryland Humanities Council. It's just been published in a Young Readers edition as well. And Daniel James Brown joins me this morning in Studio A. It's great to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So of the many, many reasons that I just loved this book, I mean, just this was a gripping, compelling, wonderful read. High among those reasons is the central character, this fellow named Joe Rance, who is one of the boys in the boat. It's an amazing story, given where he grew up, how he grew up in the, you know, Depression Pacific Northwest, to become part of this historic team. Tell us about Mr. Rance.
Yeah, Joe Rance was my neighbor, and the book actually all comes out of a conversation I had with him, I guess about 7 years ago now. His daughter invited me down to meet him. He was actually in the last couple months of his life, and he was living under hospice care at her home. And I went down, and I met this elderly gentleman, Joe Rance, and he was quite weak. He was on oxygen, but he was very alert mentally. And I sat down, and we began to talk, and he started unfolding this story, first about his childhood and adolescence growing up during the Great Depression. And he had a very, very difficult time. He had a very challenging family situation that he had to overcome. He was basically abandoned by his family as a child. And that story really got to me itself.
Yeah, his father and his stepmother basically at age 15 said, Joe, we're moving and you're not coming with us.
Basically, he came home from school one day and found the car packed and the whole family except for him in the car running. And they drove down the road and left him standing in the rain on the porch of this sort of half-finished house that his father had started. And he was on his own from that point on. And it was just, you know, he wound up having to forage in the woods for food and poach salmon out of the Dungeness River and things like that just to survive for a number of years.
Yeah, it's just remarkable. And then I guess by the time he was, by his wits and his great fortitude, he gets himself to the University of Washington.
Right.
And in a way, the guys on the boat, the crew, the people he practiced with day in and day out, they sort of became his family.
They really did. And you know, Joe was really looking for a place to fit in. And when he started a crew at the University of Washington in 1933, it took a while for him to fit in because he had become so independent. He tended not to trust other people, and actually rowing is a sport that's all about trust and fitting in. So he struggled for a while. But eventually, by 1936, he and this bunch of boys came together. They trusted each other on a very deep level. And yeah, they wound up going to Berlin and rowing for an Olympic gold medal against a German boat in front of Adolf Hitler. And that was really a transforming experience for all of them, but especially for Joe, who had struggled so hard to find a place and find acceptance. It was just an enormously important thing in his life.
And you mentioned that you met him right at the end of his life.
Yeah.
But what was he like? I'm struck as I learn about him through your book as a young man, as a kid and then a young man, mm-hmm. This enormous fortitude. I mean, is this the only word I can think of? And what's his countenance like? What's it like being in the room with him?
You know, that was part of what was amazing. On that first day that I met him, when Judy had me down to her house, Joe was one of the most relentlessly optimistic people that I've ever met. He really preferred to look on the bright side of everything. Even, you know, he was dying when I met him, and he was still focused on what he was going to do later that day or the next day. And that's the way he made it through his whole life, and I think it's how he made it through the very difficult times he had during the Depression and later in life, too, to some extent. It was really this sort of attitude of optimism. He wasn't bitter. He was treated so badly by his family, and yet he somehow managed to not grow bitter, as I think most of us would be inclined to do. When I talked to him later about how he'd been treated by his stepmother in particular, he just didn't see any point in spending time, giving voice to how she had treated him. He just wanted to move on.
Hate's just, you know, wasted energy.
Exactly. Interesting.
Of course, there are a number of other really fascinating characters in the book. Another is an English guy who also grew up in a sort of hardscrabble situation. His name is George Pocock. You begin each chapter with little sayings from Mr. Pocock. He's the guy who perfected the art of making the shells, making the boats.
Exactly. Yeah, George Pocock grew up in Great Britain. He was a masterful shell builder of these racing shells, and he constructed them out of Western red cedar, this beautiful wood, and they're absolutely gorgeous things to see. And he was just the consummate craftsman. But he was also a very good oarsman. And so he became this presence at the University of Washington Shell House in the 1930s. And in many ways, he was a sort of sage-like figure for these boys. He taught them to approach rowing the way he approached the building of his shells. That is, to put their whole heart into it, to take pride in how they rowed every time they went out to row, to approach it as if it were a craft. And that really centered a lot of these boys and gave them a purpose to what they were doing. And so, yeah, we put a quote from Pocock at the beginning of every chapter in the book because he was such a presence hanging over these boys and in the shell house. We wanted his sort of spirit to hang over the story. And one way to do that was to put these quotes through the book.
I'm fascinated as well with the coach of the crew team, Alvin Ulbrichtsen. And he talks about finding just the right mix of elements to put together an 8-man group that could make this boat go faster than anybody else. And it's not just strength and endurance and athletic ability. It's a spiritual quest as well.
It really is. You know, Bob Burns, who is the current director of rowing at the University of Washington, told me very emphatically early on in this project. He said, "I would never take the strongest man or the strongest woman in one of my shells, clone that man or woman, and put 8 identical rowers in a boat and expect it to do well." Part of what's interesting about crew is it's not just about strength. And a great crew is a crew that is a careful balancing of both physical types and physical abilities on the one hand, but also psychological types and personality traits on the other hand. It takes somebody to fire the boat up. It takes somebody to calm the crew down. It takes various kinds of leadership skills. And what Ulbrichtsen was brilliant at was the sort of alchemy of putting one of these boats together, the mixing and matching that is involved. And that's what he did so successfully in 1936.
Because he talked about the importance of character of each of the individual rowers and then this collective character of the boat. I never would have thought of this before I read your book, that character even played into it.
Oh, it plays it into enormous, enormous role in it. I mean, there are certain character traits that these 9 young men really, I think, all shared. They all had a great deal of perseverance. They all had a great deal of resilience. And interestingly, every one of them had an element of humility. Crew is a funny thing because in one hand, you have to be sort of audacious to go out for it. It's a hard sport, particularly at the Olympic level. So you have to have a fairly big ego in that sense. But it really is all about fitting in with other people. So you also have to have the ability to hold that ego back. And coaches sometimes say that great rowers have both big ego and little ego and know when to deploy both of those.
Yeah. You talk about the term that they use in rowing. And again, I'm coming to this book as a person who's never rowed crew, doesn't know anything about it, about the importance of swing.
Yeah.
In my other life, I'm a musician. Mm-hmm. And I know Count Basie used to talk about when the band really got it right, they found themselves in the pocket.
That's
what he would call it.
Right.
And these oarsmen have to get in the pocket and get this swing. What do folks mean by swing?
You know, rowers, when they talk about swing, they literally tear up. They get misty-eyed because it's a pretty rare thing. But when everything in a boat, both physically and psychologically, is in perfect alignment, and all the oars are going into the water perfectly and coming out of the water perfectly, there sometimes, and it's a fairly rare thing, there sometimes comes this phenomenon that rowers called swing. And when that happens, the effort, although there's an enormous amount of effort in moving one of these boats, the effort becomes effortless, is the way they talk about it. And I think it's sort of analogous to sort of a second wind when you're running or something like that. It becomes, although you're exerting yourself at a phenomenal level, you don't notice, you don't feel the effort, you just feel the swing of the boat. And as I say, it's something that rowers are just, you know, some say they've only found swing in a boat a few times. Sometimes crews say that they can do it fairly regularly.
An elusive quest, isn't it?
Yes.
Daniel James Brown is my guest. His book is called The Boys in the Boat. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. The enormous energy. I mean, we can talk all we want about character and swing and all that stuff, but the enormous energy it takes. I mean, you say at one point that it's like rowing a 10-minute race is like equivalent to playing two basketball games or something. It's amazing how many calories can be expended in the course of this endeavor.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a tremendous toll on the body too, frankly. I mean, again, especially at this level, the Olympic level. But when you row, for one thing, you use every muscle in your body, literally from the smallest muscles in your fingertips to feather the oars, all the way up to the biggest muscles in your legs and your back to power the boat forward. And so it takes an enormous amount of energy expended in a very short period of time. A 2,000-meter race takes about 6 minutes. And a rowing coach once said that in those 6 minutes, you will expend the same amount of energy that you would if you had played two NBA basketball games back to back done it in 6 minutes.
Yeah, and done it in 6 minutes. It's also amazing. In 1935, you mentioned that the term Dust Bowl entered the lexicon.
Right.
It was quite a difficult time for our country. Rowing and crew was a hugely popular sport. I mean, you talk about these meets where tens of thousands of people, 75,000, 100,000 people showed up to these things.
Yeah.
It's amazing to think of that.
It's hard to get your head around it these days because it's not that way anymore. But yes. And, you know, it wasn't just in Boston, for instance, where rowing still is quite popular, but all over the country, wherever there was water, you'd get 60, 70, 80, 90,000, 100,000 people out on a Saturday afternoon to watch one of these races. Major races were covered live, coast to coast on radio, which was then a brand new medium. A coxswain's sore throat would make headlines in newspapers. It was, it really rivaled college football and baseball for the amount of ink that was spilled in the sports pages covering it. So it was enormously popular as a spectator sport.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating read. And, of course, you speak at length about the geopolitical implications of this team winning at Hitler's Olympics and Hitler's reasons for having the Olympics. It's just terrific. So enjoy the rest of your time here in Maryland, and thanks so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Daniel James Brown, the book is called The Boys in the Boat, Nine Americans and Their Epic Quest for Gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. It's this year's One Maryland, One Book selection by the Maryland Humanities Council. You can discuss the book today with Daniel James Brown at 11 o'clock at Glen Burnie High School and tonight at the Jernigan Institute at the National Federation of the Blind. That's near Riverside Park in downtown Baltimore. There are many other discussions about the book planned all over the state over the next few months. Come to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and we'll throw you the link for all the details. And this program reminder, Phoebe Stein, the Executive Director of the Maryland Humanities Council, hosts Humanities Connection here on WYPR every Thursday afternoon during All Things Considered. Coming up a little later on the program, the great jazz musician Carl Grubbs joins me to talk about his musical tribute to Charm City. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
And welcome back, everybody. Free Fall Baltimore kicks off tomorrow, and for the entire month of October, artists and arts organizations all around Baltimore will offer free concerts exhibitions, and performances. And one of the most highly anticipated of these will take place Saturday afternoon when the great jazz saxophonist, composer, and teacher Carl Grubbs presents a piece inspired by Baltimore's Inner Harbor. The piece is called Inner Harbor Suite Revisited, a tribute to Baltimore. And Carl Grubbs joins me in the studio along with his wife, Barbara Harrell Grubbs, who produces events like this for their organization, Contemporary Arts. Good morning and welcome to you both.
Good morning.
So, Carl, how does a place, a physical place, serve as the muse for a musical composition?
Well, you know, when I first moved here, I didn't know that much about Baltimore, so it took me a while to really get used to being here, and really I just started learning things about it that, you know, about the city that I didn't know. And I'm a people watcher. You know, I like to sit back and just watch people and not say anything. And just from that, I just kind of get the vibe about what's going on.
And the harbor's a great place to do that.
Yeah, and then I'm a musician, so that's the way I can express myself is through the music, you know.
And Barbara, you do, for example, every year a tribute to John Coltrane, Carl's cousin, I guess, right? Naima was married to John Coltrane,
yes.
So Carl, knew John Coltrane and sort of studied at his feet. You do these kinds of events throughout the year through your organization, Contemporary Arts. This particular project grew from a Baker Artist Award, and it brings a lot of different people together, doesn't it?
Yes, and it's really a Ruby's Project grant. Mm-hmm. He received, managed by the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance, funded by the Deutsche Foundation. So we've taken that grant and we've just tried to stretch it out and make sure that Baltimoreans have access to the music and have an opportunity to hear this love song.
Yeah.
To the city of Baltimore, this tribute to the city of Baltimore. So we're very excited about having this time, this second or third time around, being able to do that.
Yeah, that's why you're calling it Revisited, because have you tweaked it a little bit since you first composed it?
Yes. Well, I added strings, really a string quartet, which is good. Mm-hmm. And then I also wrote some newer material. I have this piece that I call Water. It's just strings in the rhythm section. And I was going to play on it, but then when I heard the strings play it, I said, it's nothing more for me to play, So
So let's talk about the scoring. So you've got a string quartet, you've got two violins, a viola, and a cello.
Yes.
And then you're playing sax. Who else is playing?
Piano, bass, drums, and percussion.
Mm-hmm. And was that juxtaposition of the sort of classical acoustic instruments and the jazz instrumentation, was that a challenge and fun to do?
Yes. It's interesting. Normally, I would use piano, bass, and drums and saxophone, but I've noticed that having a percussionist really gives the rhythm section to sound fuller to me. And then too, having the strings, it just added another color and flavor to the music. And this is something I've been wanting to do for a while. So when I had the chance to do it, I just jumped on it.
Yeah. And of course, the Inner Harbor, Barbara, a great place to do it because that's where this whole idea came from. And this is actually going to be outside in Pierce's Park. Now we got our fingers crossed about the weather.
Yes.
They're talking about, hurricanes landing on the coast of Virginia, on Saturday night. So who knows what the weather will be like. But this will be an outdoor event right in the thick of things.
Right. Well, we began to work on this in 1983 when Carl received his National Endowment Grant. That was an exciting moment because Merchants of Harvard Place gave us an opportunity to perform in the Pratt Street Building. And so we thought, where else should it be but at the Inner Harbor, where it was conceived and the ideas were conceived by Carl. So we've been excitedly trying to pursue opportunities to present the Inner Harbor Suite throughout the years.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be fun, and I'm honored to be asked to be the sort of the MC for the event. So
yes.
We're going to keep our fingers crossed about the rain, and we will see you all on Saturday afternoon.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for
coming
in. Carl Grubbs will present his Inner Harbor Suite at Baltimore's Inner Harbor Saturday afternoon at 4 o'clock. Come on down and join us. We'll be in Pierce's Park. That's right next to the Columbus Center on Pier 5 in the Inner Harbor in Baltimore. More information on our website, wipr.org/ Maryland Morning. There's a lot going on this weekend, not only in the Inner Harbor, but a few blocks east as well in Little Italy. I want to welcome to the show Sid Wolf, who along with her husband Germano Fabiani run Germano's Cabaret in Little Italy, and they've organized the first ever Baltimore Madonari Arts Festival, in which some of the streets of Little Italy become the canvas for incredible art done with chalk. Morning, Sid. How you doing?
Good morning, Tom. I'm fine, thank you. And I'm thrilled that you and Carl are going to be just right next door to our Madonari Arts Festival on Saturday.
And this Madonari idea is something that has been going on in Europe really since the Renaissance, hasn't it?
That's right. Germano introduced the community to a form of street art that dates back to the 1600s and originated in his hometown of Florence, Italy. He thought that Little Italy was the perfect venue for a Madonari chalk festival. And the 125th year of Baltimore's Columbus celebration, and of course, Freefall Baltimore, was the perfect time.
So what happens? You're going to close off a few streets, and then you're going to have people who are particularly skilled. I mean, they're experts who concentrate in this craft of making drawings on the street, huh?
Yeah, well, in fact, we're closing South High Street to cars from Pratt to Eastern. And with this weather, the artists will be tented, so they'll be able to continue to make their masterpieces. There are 60 artists who are coming to Baltimore. Some of them are local, some from the MICA community, Baltimore School for the Arts, visual arts students are involved. And we have three Italians from Florence, three Madonari artists who are joining us. We're very, very excited about that. I should also mention that Baltimore has its own Maestro Madonaro, and that is Michael Kirby, who you may know. He's very involved in murals in Baltimore. So it's shaping up to be an incredible event. In addition to the visual artists, we have over 90 performing artists joining us, including Trina Coleman, who you know well.
Yeah, good friend of mine, wonderful singer, fronts a band called Sojourn. Yep, uh-huh.
And Laura Norris's Banjo Kids are joining us. She teaches actually 65 Baltimore City kids how to play the old bowback mandolin, and some of her artists will join us. And the Baltimore School for the Arts Senior Acting Ensemble will be roving from restaurant to restaurant performing scenes from Carlo Goldoni's A Servant of Two Masters. Opera singers, Karen Myers, you may know Karen, and Italian-American tenor Aaron Caruso will be joining us.
Yeah, so you got a whole crew. That's going to be a lot of fun. Okay, well, have a great time. And this is the first year that you've done it, and hopefully not the last. That's terrific.
Well, thank you.
Okay, Sid Wolf, the Madonari Arts Festival starts tomorrow night, runs through Sunday in Baltimore's Little Italy. You can enjoy music, some masters of chalk art, of course, the Columbus Day Parade on Sunday, and the food for which Little Italy is famous. We've got a link to all the details on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Friday morning on Maryland Morning, we'll talk movies with Ann Hornaday and Jed Dietz. Until then, thanks so much for being with us. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production of
Your Public Radio,
WYPR, in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnny McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1935, the Baltimore City Council voted 18-1 to ask the American Olympic Committee to withdraw all U.S. teams from participation in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. The resolution was described as bristling with denunciation of the Nazis' persecution of Jews and Catholics. We're back on Friday. Hope you will be too.